We're having an enormous discussion today that really rattled us on both sides on the question of the alpha effect. And it's so big because so many people here have worked on it. And I guess what I'm personally hoping as a bystander is that I can really understand where the disagreement is.
If there isn't.
Nobody knows.
But we're still waiting for what you
said.
Why don't I start? So I kind of just as an introduction, just point out where this whole alpha picture fits into the kind of things we've been talking about so far. Much of our discussion is focused, if you imagine this is an energy and this is a wave number, much of the discussion so far is focused on what happens to the energy system. The input turbulence, which is the red here, and we plotted the small scale dynamo of the turbulent amplification and focuses on what goes on at k larger than the forcing scale. So, for example, we've seen factors that look like this, and whether in saturation the thing ends up looking like this or like this. One thing that is generally agreed is that the integral under the magnetic, which is blue, is equal to the more or less neat partition of kinetic energy below the forcing scale. But we talked only a little bit about what happens above forcing scale in the discussions of the mean field dynamo. And this is where the mean field dynamo enters the picture. It's kind of a framework for understanding inverse cascade.
So that blue rising curve is the forcing function?
No. This is a magnetic field. And these are just two examples of possible saturated states of a magnetic field on the forcing scale above, and the k is above the forcing scale. And I haven't drawn anything in this region since that's where the mean field dynamo enters, and that's what some of the discussion is going to be on today. We have seen a bit of the mean field dynamo on Tobias and Hughes earlier, just to put it in perspective. So the point is that if you're inputting energy on the forcing scale, if you take the galaxy for an example, if you put energy in on a supernova on 100 parsec scale, the question is what kind of power can you get on scale larger than that input forcing scale? So this inverse cascade, it requires a pseudo-scalar. And to see that, to see the mean field dynamo framework of this inverse cascade, the mean, if you split the magnetic field up into mean and fluctuating flux, like we have seen once before, you get an equation that looks like this. And this term is your pseudoscalar. This is the alpha term. This alpha term depends on correlation of fluctuating quantities. So without this pseudoscalar, which is something like the kinetic helicity or the current helicity, in other words, reflection, which is not reflection invariant. This is the term that allows you to go from small scale up to growing mean. Now, in the traditional approach to this problem, which is in the literature, so for example, explaining the large scale field of the sun, and the Earth is motivated by, particularly the Sun, where the turbulence is very important, originally by Parker and Steenbeck, Krauss, and Radler, and others. It's traditionally been in the textbook that alpha has been taken to be a given function of the velocity. And the velocity was assumed to be prescribed, and you then simply solve this magnetic induction equation with an alpha, which is independent of the growth of the magnetic field. So that's the kinematic theory, and that's the kind of textbook theory, and it's obviously incomplete, and that's why we're all here. That is, you need to couple the MHD equation together to really understand how any correlation between turbulent quantities depend on between turbulent velocities or fluctuating field depend on the magnetic field and the velocity as the system evolves. So this, the question is, does this dynamic back reaction, once you've included the back reaction of the growing field, both the small scale and large scale field, on the on this dynamo alpha, this helicity term, does this suppress this helicity term? And the debate is largely of a formula like this. It is thought that the suppression will indeed play a role somewhere when there's some sense of equipartition between the magnetic field, some fraction of equipartition between the mean magnetic field and the fluctuating magnetic field. Now this fluctuating random magnetic field is an equipartition with a turbulent velocity. And the question is, how large does the mean field have to be with respect to this random field before the alpha dynamo coefficient is suppressed? And it's some power of the magnetic Reynolds number is thought to enter this suppression. P could be zero. And so essentially, whether P is zero or whether P is one is kind of the crux of the debate
I think that's both characterizing the fact that it need not have this form at all.
Let me just...
It may not even depend on the mean field squared.
That's fair enough.
It may just depend on the fluctuating field.
You mean the whole...
Suppression of alpha. It might just depend on the fluctuating field and not on the mean field at all.
That's true. It's just that in...
That might not depend on the magnetic Reynolds number.
I mean, everything you're saying is right. If P is zero, there would be no sense in the reference. The reason I present this is because this is what has been commonly presented as the form for the suppression. So it's not necessarily the correct form. It's just that it's the formula around which much of the debate has focused. So whether or not, if people have other formulas, that's certainly worth presenting. But there seems to be a variety of reasons why something like this. Now, that sort of brings up the question of what good is this whole thing anyway, why study it? The reason partly is that it's a simple picture characterizing the inverse cascade, and so in as much as one has simulations which you can run for stability and watch the inverse cascade grow, there's something to be said for having some analytic picture of why that happens. And so if this analytic picture eventually survives pulling on in your simulation, then it gives us some understanding. Because we can understand how the field grows in this picture in terms of twisting field lines and more or less classical simple pictures given by Parker. But so there's a lot of, so in a sense it's sort of a framework or basis for making predictions to simulations and for trying to understand what's happening in simulations and ultimately understanding observations. So that's it. Just my semi speaker. Matthias is going to talk about the alpha as the current sort of galaxy kind of an observational input. And then there's sort of more theoretical discussion of the suppression answer. But again, Pat's going to talk about some analytic calculations. And we'll use some numerical simulations about the suppression. I'm going to give some interpretation of the role of magnetic helicity in this process. George is going to talk about an analytic study of the nonlinear back reaction, and Axel will have more simulations at the end. So,
I guess before we really start discussing this alpha quenching in the case of a nice turbulent cascade, I thought I would just give you a simple picture of what alpha can be in the case of our galaxy. So, as you all know, I mean, the primary source of turbulent motions in the galaxy is probably supernova explosions. And now here, it's important to distinguish between the two types of supernovae. type 1 supernovae arise from old degenerate stars, and they have a low frequency, a frequency of about 1 every 450 years or so in our galaxy. And all of them are isolated, so they just occur at random. Now, type 2 supernovae arise from young, massive stars, and they have a much higher frequency, maybe 1 every 50 years or so in the galaxy. And yeah?
One question. Is there some concern that that might be reversed for other galaxies, that type 1 might be more common than type 2 in other galaxies?
No, actually these numbers are based on different things, but in particular on the surveys, including a lot of external galaxies. So I think that's more like an average for galaxies like our own. But that's, yeah. Okay.
In particular, you wouldn't have the type 2s in a elliptical galaxy, right?
Yeah, for one thing, yeah. Yeah, I'm talking about galaxies like our own galaxy.
Right.
Yeah. Now, for the type 2 supernovae, and that's important, you can estimate that, well, most of the young massive stars are born in clusters, but some of these stars are ejected from the cluster early in the cluster's lifetime. And as a result, you can estimate that about 40% of the type 2 supernovae will end up not in the cluster, in the parent cluster, but somewhere in the field. So these will be isolated supernovae. And the other 60% will end up in the cluster itself. So if you put these things together, you can estimate that the isolated supernovae, which are basically all the type 1 and then 40% of the type 2, will give rise to what are isolated, and they have a frequency of about, well, 1 per century in the case of our galaxy. And all of these will give rise to individual supernova remnants. In contrast, the clustered supernovae, which are basically the 60% of cluster of type 2 supernovae, have a frequency which is like 1 over 85 years, which is very close to this number. But these now will not give rise to individual supernovae, but they will all act together to give rise to a superbubble, basically. So superbubbles are just like individual supernova remnants, but only they are much larger, and they live for a much longer time. Now, the number of clustered supernovae for one superbubble varies a lot. I mean, the average number is maybe 30. So on average, it requires like 30 clustered supernovae to produce one superbubble. But the number varies a lot between, let's say, a minimum of 4 to a maximum of a few thousand. So there is a huge spread. Okay, so what I did is try to calculate the alpha tensor, the whole tensor, due to supernova explosions in our galaxy. And the way I did is, well, basically I proceeded in two steps. In the first step, I tried to derive formal analytical expressions for alpha, for the whole tensor, due to a distribution. Yeah?
What's the difference in this trend of numbers?
Oh, there's different ways. If you look at H2 regions, that's a way to estimate the number of progenitor stars, you know, in clusters, and you can see there's a whole spread.
So this is expected. That,
no, you observe it. You observe
supernova.
Yeah, you know that all massive stars above, let's say, 8 solar masses will produce a type 2 supernova. And these are the stars which give rise to the H2 regions, for instance. There are different ways of estimating that. Okay, yeah. So what I did in my calculation is first try to derive analytical expressions for alpha in the case of explosions in a rotating disk. So I have a disk which is rotating and stratified along its axis. And I just consider a distribution of explosions and work out what alpha should be in that case. And what I get is something like that. No, there's no more.
Some there, under the, right under
the screen. Oh, there's one here. Sorry? One's gone.
Yes.
I have one. Okay. Anyhow, so what I found is something like alpha is equal to an integral over the distribution of explosions. times the function of, well, two things. On the one hand, the parameters of the large case velocity field, so omega, the rotation rate, and g, the shear rate, which is as important, and then a few dynamical parameters, properties of the remnant produced by a given explosion. Typically, the lifetime of the remnant, since then, and its maximum cross-sectional area at different z. Okay, so that's what my formal expressions look like.
Could you elaborate for me, maybe others, how alpha in that formula comes from this? What is the physics of it?
Yeah, that's right. Okay. That's a simple picture to illustrate this. I showed a few graphs earlier, but I can go through it. I think it's worth it. So that's like a view from the galaxy seen from above. So here you have the galactic center, and the whole thing is rotating at angular velocity omega above the center. And so that view graph shows you the effect of just one given explosion. So you assume that an explosion occurs here, in the let's say in the plane of the galaxy, and you assume that in this medium, the field is initially in this direction, okay? As shown in green. So what the explosion does is drive an outward propagating shockwave in the medium, and the shockwave will just sweep out all the gas in the field line, which will then pilot and collapse into a shell, which is spherical in this case. Well, that's one thing. If there is all there was to it, then you wouldn't get any alpha effect. But these are diverging motions, which take place in a rotating environment. So they will be acted upon by the Coriolis force, which will act in this direction. It will accelerate the gas in the direction opposite to the large-scale rotation, so like this, okay? And so the field lines will not follow the dotted line here, but they will be twisted, and so they will follow the solid line. And that's really the basis of the alpha effect. It's the production of magnetic field in the direction perpendicular to the mean field.
Is stratification vital for getting them on their alpha? Not obvious, but you have these explosions.
That's right.
And they expand, but they could be one from here.
Yeah, you need some gradient somewhere. And the main gradient here is in the distribution of supernovae. Basically, if you have them all in the plane, you will get some field, BR. Let's say that B is initially in the phi direction. So the field you need to create in this case is BR. Well, if you can see this in 3D, the BR will be outwards, here, way above the plane, and then inwards. So negative in the plane. And that's what you need because you know the story. This BR will get rid of by diffusion and stuff. And what will remain is this BR, the negative one, in the plane. So if all the explosions take place in the plane, you're fine. Or if you have a gradient, you know, in the distribution of supernova explosions. You don't really need to have a stratification in the gas density or so. It's better. I mean, it has and it's there, but it's not required. Okay, so that's a physical picture of the alpha effect.
Explosions and acting like buoyancy.
In a way, yeah, same effect. Buoyancy would mean diverging motion and counter rotation, and it's exactly what happens here. Yeah. Okay, so I showed you, Oh yeah, and by the way, for alpha psi, this would be something like was something like this. So that's like the maximum cross-sectional area, and that's D, the height above the explosion center, and that gives you like an escape velocity at which the flux is removed. And this is like the angle by which the field lines are twisted by the Coriolis force. So that answers. You can see the different parameters, omega, and then the different quantities related to the given explosion. So what I did then is try to estimate these quantities, Cm and Sm, for realistic explosions in the galaxy. And so to do that, I constructed a model of the interstellar medium in our galaxy. And the model is really based on all the observational data I could get on the gas density, the pressure from gas, from magnetic fields, cosmic rays, gravity, everything I could get, which is needed to build a model of the interstellar medium. And then I wrote a code which is able to follow the expansion of a large number of supernova, supernova remnants, and superbubbles in the model interstellar medium. And so the code just follows the expansion of each supernova remnant, then calculates these two qualities, and then integrates over the distribution of supernova explosions and superbubbles. And that gives me an estimate for alpha, for the different components of alpha. So that's the idea.
So this is a function of time or what? Where you average out time?
No, that's a function on the distribution. I mean, the integration in time, I've done it analytically. And that's the result of the integration. And all I have to do now is integrate over the distribution of supernovae.
You have to assume what happens after the explosion is over. You assume the field snaps back to its original.
No. The underlying assumption here is that, okay, field lines are swept, and the expansion stops, let's say, when the expansion velocity drops to something like the sound speed. I mean, the signal speed, I should say, because it includes gas pressure, but also magnetic pressure and cosmic-ray pressure. So when that happens, when the expansion velocity drops to the signal speed outside, then I assume that the expansion stops. What happens is the shock wave disappears, the shell fragments, that creates a lot of turbulence, and I assume that reconnection occurs at that time. But I think it's okay if not the whole reconnection occurs. It has to start at that point.
Well, you've really got to guarantee that this doesn't spring back before the omega part, the shear, has sort of taken the foot points around. Right? I mean, there's a crucial time here, which is the time for the omega part of the alpha omega dynamo to pull the foot points around. This twists the foot points, and they have to overtake each other. But there'll be a time for the flux to spring back down.
Yeah,
right?
But I think as long as the remnant hasn't merged yet, you'll find this tension in the field line. It's really not important. It's a first order effect, and it's not that important.
I think it is. I mean, I calculated the spring back time, right?
I mean, the dominant force here during the expansion is the pressure inside the cavity, or ram pressure, same thing. And it's really larger than this magnetic tension.
Sure.
And the reason is that the shell is so thin. Mm-hmm. It's thin. I mean, it's thickness.
But it moves down, right? It goes up. It goes up. And then the field line tension is going to bring these lines right back.
Okay, and I'm trying to say is that it goes up, then the shell will fragment, and so you won't have a coherent shell anymore. So you won't have really this effect.
Sure, the field lines are still attached to the body.
Well,
even if it reconnects, they still spring back down.
I don't know. Nothing. No.
And what is it going to reconnect with itself up there, but there's still field lines down here, unless they've moved around each other.
Wouldn't it depend a lot on the buoyancy, like if the buoyancy was sufficient to keep it going up, or?
I mean, the field reconnects. It won't try to come back down.
Thanks.
Okay.
Too long a conversation.
What if it comes back down? It leaves all the remnant stuff out there. I mean, there's
just floats away. It just floats away into the hail. Oh, yeah, but it'll have a net effect still.
Excuse me, just as non-specialist, what fuel lines would you expect to reconnect?
But the whole thing, I mean, you have to imagine that the field line breaks in different places when the remnant surges, and these pieces of field lines will reconnect to the ambient field. And I don't think, okay, in different places. So it's like you split the field lines and you deposit the result in the ambient medium. And I don't think the bubbles will really blow into the halo. Is it something you refer to?
No, whatever happens to reconnect. Garbage up there that does push towards the halo in the classical picture.
Yeah, I don't think it will really blow into the halo because you still have a lot of gas there. You know, the early calculations said that the gold bubble is really exploding, bursts through the gas layer and goes into the halo. But you still have a lot of gas there. You know, the wind, the hot gas, a lot of pressure which contains these bubbles. Okay.
What about the chimneys?
Yeah.
Are the chimneys an example of blowout, or are they interpreted some of the way?
for the, well, that would be a possibility. Mm-hmm. But I think a real blowout occurs only for extremely powerful bubbles, just because, you know, of all the gas and pressure up there. So
that's not true. In our simulations where we do this, even individual supernova can do form a chimney. It's very common.
Well, it depends on the gas stratification you have, the profile of the gas density.
We have a realistic...
well, we have to see that, yeah. That's really the basis of the system.
It seems to me that the best chance for recognition you have is when the field has been swept into the thin shell.
Mm-hmm.
And the bubble of supernova remnant is in the cooling phase, the radiative phase.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So if you can't do your reconnection then it's sort of, when the shell dissolves, things just expand a little. You have a limited time to do your reconnection.
I mean, that's a constraint, of course. What you can argue is that you have a lot of turbulence upon reconnection, upon merging, when the shell fragments. You can imagine that you have a cloud colliding or whatever. Depends how high you are. Yeah, okay. I thought I would just show you what these bubbles look like. Okay, like this is a cross section across the galaxy, and that's the vertical axis. And that's what an individual supernova remnant looks like. So that's the bubble produced just by one explosion. And it has a radius of about 50 parsecs and a lifetime of about 1.5 million years. Okay, so that's like a remnant. Now this is the bubble produced by 30 explosions. And it lived about 13 million years, almost 10 times more than an individual remnant. And now its radius in the plane is about 200 parsecs. So it's more. And you see that this bubble is no longer spherical, but it's elongated in the perpendicular direction. And that, of course, is due to the stratification. So because the gas density and the pressure both decrease away from the midplane, it's simply easier for a bubble to expand in the vertical direction. Okay, now the next one here is a bubble produced by, oh yeah, by the way, that's just an average typical superbubble because it's produced by the average number of supernovae per superbubble, which is 30. That's a powerful superbubble which is produced by 10 times more supernovae. And you see that, again, it is elongated perpendicularly to the plane, but in addition, it is pinched here at the equator. And that's because of the layer of very dense gas which exists near the midplane. So again, this bubble finds it difficult to expand in this layer, but as soon as it manages to burst through the layer, then it will balloon out in the low-density region above and below this layer. And that's why it has like a peanut shape. And this is, again, a bubble produced by 300 supernovae, but now the explosions occur slightly above the midplane, and because of that, the result is extremely asymmetric. So it's very hard to expand in this layer of gas, but it's very easy to expand above it. So that's what I get. And finally, I'll show you what the components of alpha look like after the whole calculation is done. Yeah, forget the last row. This is beta. But so here you can see the four non-vanishing components of the alpha tensor. So the three diagonal components, alpha phi, alpha r, alpha z. And that's the off-diagonal component, which is like alpha r phi. And it has the meaning of an effective vertical escape velocity. And okay, that's what the contour plots look like. So you can see that all these parameters peak at about 7 kiloparsec from the center and maybe something like 2 kiloparsec above the midplane.
What's their normalization in terms of the velocity?
Okay. Here it's in kilometers per second, so you have something like 2.5 kilometers per second for alpha phi, which is the dominant component, the most important. And for the escape velocity, you have something like 15 kilometers per second.
So that's like the
equivalent
is if you take 10 kilometers a second, it's a down by factor.
Yeah. Volume. And part of it is because you have this factor, omega times Tm, which is less than 1, of course. And maybe the last point is, since we're discussing alpha quenching, we usually think about the alpha quenching as being due to magnetic tension in the bent field line. And here, it is more due to an increase in the external pressure. If you increase the magnetic field strength, you increase the external pressure, solar pressure, so you increase the signal speed, and so these bubbles will merge earlier. That means they will have a smaller lifetime and a smaller size, so they will give a smaller contribution to alpha. So in this picture, that's where the alpha quenching comes from, which is different from what people usually do. So I guess that's all for the picture.
So this is a play in three acts, very short acts, I hope. I want to start by discussing quenching of magnetic diffusion in two dimensions, which is something of a kindler, gentler problem, which in fact, the consideration of which I think it was the subject of the first paper by Cattaneo and von Stein that triggered a lot of this. And then we'll move back to the main event, alpha and beta effects in 3D. And finally, I want to talk about some progress toward, I think, agreement for a change that took place here a few weeks ago on the subject of getting off the hook, particularly on the effects of non-stationarity and other things. And just so we review, I mean, in 2D MHD, you describe the system by coupled equations for the vorticity and the magnetic potential. The vorticity feels the J cross B force. There are three quadratic conserved quantity, energy, mean square, flux, and cross-solicity. I should say that for all our calculations, we take zero cross-solicity ab initio, so this completely rules out alignment effects. Secondly, we always for better or for worse, look at magnetic Prandtl number of order unity. So, and the problem in two dimensions is if you envision some spatially profiled mean flux, you might ask, how does it relax? And in particular, what can you say about the cross-field transport of magnetic potential? And the object of the game is to calculate, if you'll pardon my poor choice of words, the spatial flux of magnetic potential, or flux of flux. And this, of course, is a quadratic quantity, which is every bit as much the realm of mean field electrodynamics as the helicity is. The sort of classical lore on the problem is to say that the flux of potential is just some diffusion coefficient times a gradient, a Fick's law, and that this diffusion coefficient would be the kind of the usual kinematic thing set by the velocity fluctuation spectrum and the eddy turnover rate. And the reason why that ought to give you a red flag is that it's well known that there is a kind of resiliency in the magnetic potential dynamics. Of course, if the fluid energy is much larger, and we have to quantify how much, then the magnetic energy psi is just mixed as a passive scalar. If, however, the magnetic energy is larger, such as might be the case if viscosity were bigger than diffusivity, or you just load a large amount of magnetic energy, it's also well known that magnetic flux structures coalesce on large scale. And basically, this is a generalization of the idea of island coalescence, sort of simply attraction of current filaments. And this clearly sort of points the finger at opposing effects, and particularly that the presence of small-scale magnetic fluctuations introduces a resiliency. Another powerful handle on life in two dimensions is what seems by some people to be called the Zeldovich theorem, which is just, if you're not into jargon, is merely the statement of conservation of square of magnetic potential. And just from working from the magnetic potential equation, four stationary states, the Zeldovich theorem immediately gives a balance between dissipation of magnetic energy by resistivity and the transport. And this is a very powerful effect because it essentially says mean square psi balance constrains the flux to the dissipation. Okay? You can rewrite this relation as a relation between the energy and the square of the mean field with the proportionality factor of the magnetic Reynolds number. And this also tells you that a modest B average gives you a large B tilde squared. So you get a lot of bang of resiliency for a modest B average. So the message here is that flux transport is closely linked to small scale magnetic energy. And then if you go and calculate it, and of course, as Eric was saying, you now have to break with the sort of kinematic tradition a la Moffat. You can't really assume that you know the velocity field and all its dynamics, and just that B goes along for the ride. You have to treat the two contributions on an equal footing, and in particular incorporate the back reaction of the Lorentz force through the vorticity equation. You find that the next net transport of potential is proportional to the difference of fluid and magnetic energy. And of course, this difference is the signal for the back reaction, or harkens back to mixing due to passive scalar versus coalescence. And this result was first obtained by Pouquet in 1978, and in some sense that was this minus sign sitting here was a harbinger of things to come.
Can I just ask something?
Yeah.
This V tilde,
yeah.
Is it the actual velocity field? Or the velocity field would have been, had it been any B?
It's the actual velocity field. Okay?
And now the geometry, so the dominant component of field is out of the plane?
No, this is B, the B is in the plane. So you think of a box and you say you have a B in the X direction. Right. Right. By the way, you said a key word there, waves. And if I had 15 hours instead of 15 minutes, an interesting question here is to what extent is the turbulence alphanized? In other words, if you force velocity, how much of that velocity, in some sense, or that energy is converted to alphane waves, how much of it remains fluid? More like eddies. And that is a complicated issue which I'd like to defer, but not all of it is alphanized, and we've done some studies of that. Okay, let me just get on with the show here. If we then use the Zeldovich theorem result as an estimate for B tilde squared and this short calculation, you find the suppressed diffusivity. Throughout, we've taken the correlation time in the response, in the calculation, the same for B and V, and assumed zero cross-felicity. And this is the analytical counterpart of the Cattaneo-Vonstein and Cattaneo results. And there was, I think you'll hear from the computations, it seemed to do pretty well when examined computationally by Fausto. What it all means is the effective flux diffusivity is tied to eta, the radical departure from kinematics, indicating a quenching of D that's nonlinear in B naught. And it reflects reflects the constraint of psi square conservation. In other words, it tells you that flux elements have memory, okay? Another way of looking at it, if you like to think in terms of Prandtl mixing length theory, it's a relation between transport and decay, and that ties you then to eta. And I think the simplest way of seeing it is that basically flux agglomeration competes against kinematic mixing. Now you say, who cares about this two-dimensional crap? Real men talk about helicity and dynamos and all that. So everybody knows this story. We're interested in computing alpha and beta, that everybody knows the kinematic lore. And you immediately are dead. If you try to blindly charge ahead, you're immediately dead.
Can I just ask a question going back to the 2D case? Back.
Sure.
In that case, you keep talking about flux agglomeration. You don't have any. Flux agglomeration must be a resistive effect.
Yeah, but I mean, the tendency.
The tendency just that the fact that the tangled field tends to. Turn all motions into alpha, like motions into spring back.
Yeah, I think though, if however, it is the case that if you were to do, for example, there was a interesting simulation done by Riopoulos in Montgomery a long time ago, which was done in, might be of interest to you, the regime of basically viscosity huge, okay? And you did see very clearly a pile up of psi squared on large scale. And if you look at the plots, you know, the visualizations from that, you see a kind of clearly a large scale, yes. And you see, and the plots look very similar. In other words, you see structures form and then they coalesce very much like island coalescence. So there's, the question, it's a very good question.
B squared is piling up on small scale.
Excuse me?
B squared.
Yeah, but B squared and psi squared, that's one of the points about 2D MHT. They don't go the same direction.
Yeah, yeah,
no. Okay.
But B squared is what produces the J cross B
force. Right. But we're talking.
But isn't the J cross B force sort of suppressing the velocity?
Yeah, but that doesn't say that psi squared can't pile up on large scale. Okay.
Yes, but I don't think that's relevant. I think what's relevant is that B squared piles up on a small scale.
I think they're both relevant. Okay, and I would point to this simulation that I referred to. I would also say that, I mean, there is certainly, as I was saying to Ellen, an amount of alphanization, in other words, which I believe is what you're getting at, sort of conversion of fluctuation energy to alphane waves. But we've looked at that in 2D, well, actually 2D EMHD. But just let me finish, please. And it's not... It is not anywhere near complete alphanization.
Presumably, if you look at the displacement of the fluid particle that goes out, it somehow springs back to where it was.
Yes, I mean, that's a way of looking at it.
Suppressing diffusion.
Right, but I think you can look, another way of looking at it is this sort of competition between the trivial passive scalar mixing and the, shall we say, inverse transfer of psi squared to large scale. I think they're both relevant ways of looking at it. Anyway, let's go on and then we can continue during the discussion period. Everyone knows the story in MHD in three dimensions. However, the Zeldovich theorem is out of business here because you no longer have conservation of psi square in three dimensions. There's an interesting issue of what happens if you're dealing with reduced MHD, where you may have rather weak breaking of psi squared conservation, but we'll leave that to another day. However, in 3D, the relevant magnetic conservation property is helicity, magnetic property is helicity, and of course helicity is conserved, and you can basically go through a similar song and dance looking at helicity balance and find an interesting relation between what I like to call the hyperhelicity, Eric calls this the current helicity, and alpha in its most general form. And this relationship, again assuming the stationary system, is purely a consequence of a helicity balance, but does relate, very interestingly, resistive diffusion again enters the picture as the proportionality constant. And this is sort of an intimate connection between helicity and the alpha effect. So then when you go to computing alpha, and again you can sort of borrow some existing results from Pouquet, Frisch, and Lehra, and again, you find this competition, and if you don't think very long, you might say, aha, the competition here doesn't really mean anything because we don't know the sign of this. However, if you think a little harder, you do know the sign of that by helicity balance, and then out falls the quenched alpha expression that we've seen already a few times today. Another thing that's interesting is I notice people love to fight over alpha, but no one likes to fight over beta in three dimensions. Actually, we did an arbitrary dimensionality calculation of beta, and we found in three dimensions beta is unchanged. Similar independent work by Eun-Jin Kim in 1999, this was in 95 or so, also came to this conclusion, and this is quite interesting because if beta were quenched, you might be able to revitalize primordial somehow. You might ask, why is this in two dimensions psi square conservation constrains eta effective? In three dimensions psi squared is not conserved. And of course, in the 3D problem, alpha is a pseudoscalar and beta is a scalar, so it's not altogether surprising that helicity conservation will constrain alpha much more readily than beta. However, that's a rather feeble excuse, and one would like to understand that better. Yeah, I think that's fair. Yeah, I think that's fair, yeah. Now, one thing I've discovered, that a lot of our differences with our critics, Eric and George here, has to do with stationarity, and in particularly these handy-dandy formulas for the quenched D and quenched alpha basically are predicated on the assumption of stationarity of mean square magnetic potential and turbulent helicity. And of course, mean field electrodynamics is traditionally done with the assumption of stationary turbulence. But it is certainly a fair game to ask what happens if you make either psi squared or magnetic helicity non-stationary. I think it's easier to do psi squared, so I did that here. And lo and behold, much like our friends, you do find a new term, which is specifically proportional to the non-stationarity. In other words, this gamma S is proportional to the time derivative of psi squared, as if, say, you were ramping it, and is proportional to the flux of psi squared through the boundary. You note that's the average of a divergence, so that reduces to a purely boundary contribution. The other thing is that this new term is finite in the eta goes to zero limit. You can see that because you'll note the 1 over resistivity here and the factor of eta here. I should say that this is not a panacea, because you then have to face the question of, if you're going to try to save the diffusion or the alpha effect with this, you have to address the origins of the helicity flux. To me, coming from fusion, this has a sort of the ring of looking at the problem of the dynamo as a helicity injection process, which is a popular strategy for sustainment of devices. Well, it would be nice then to see what happens in a non-stationary simulation. As I say, I believe all the things that Fausto and David did were stationary. If it turns out that sometimes you have to read your own papers a little more carefully. We did that, in particular Amita Das, in the paper published in January in Physics of Plasmas, looked at diffusion in two-dimensional electron magnetohydrodynamics, which I don't want to get into explaining that system to you, but in particular, for the range of Ks we were considering, which were large compared to the electron skin depth, this system is basically isomorphic to 2D MHD. That one of the variables means something different. And of course, this simulation was a decay simulation, and here, in fact, you see the time evolution of the magnetic potential. And you will note, of course, it doesn't decay a whole lot, which is precisely symptomatic of the inverse, shall we say, cascade of square magnetic potential in 2D. But it is non-stationary. And the way we D was measured is to look at tracer particle pairs oriented along and across the magnetic field. And the kinematic was if the B squared were suppressed, and the longitudinal was along the field, and the transverse was perpendicular to the field, and you do very clearly see a kind of suppression effect entering. We also looked at the diffusion scaling versus B naught squared and found a nice linear relation, and you'll just have to take my word for it, the slope of this line was consistent with a factor proportional to magnetic Reynolds number. So it appears that at least in this particular case, which was in, shall we say, a case without external, shall we say, external forcing of psi squared, that the impact of non-stationarity was rather dubious here. Boundary conditions are periodic, exactly. So there's no outflow. Fair point. However, again, you know, as I say, to appeal to that, I mean, if you're going to go the helicity injection route, which is an interesting route, then you've got to come up with the process that does it at sufficient rate. Okay. There are other escape routes, all of which boil down to fleeing mean field electrodynamics. One is to appeal to some sort of ordered large-scale modes or flow where you would abandon homogeneity and isotropy. It's no matter how you play that game, it's tough to see how magnetic fluctuation effect, back reaction effects are avoided. I mean, there may be an interesting angle here of trying to work with something like the Balbus-Hawley type of mechanism where you intrinsically get bigger magnetic energy than fluid energy and rely on sort of the magnetic fluctuation helicity as a driver. And there's elements of this scenario in some of Peter Gilman's recent work related to the effects of modes at the base of the convection zone. So it's sort of where that's heading. I guess he's appearing here somewhere in the festival, so you can hear more from him. Another strategy with Eric has advocated is to appeal to, you know, intermittency or structures or flux tubes, whatever that means. I can't say that I understand much about flux tubes, but whenever flux tubes come out, I notice always that fast reconnection of a flux tube comes out, and you have to address the question of where you get that. And in particular, if you appeal to turbulence, you're back with topological conservation constraints regulating the reconnection process. So you've got to think about that. And finally, you can just go outside of MHD. So. Any more complaints? Yes, sir.
Just one comment on the 3D diffusion not being suppressed.
Mm-hmm.
There's a paper by Feinstein, Sagave, and Rosner, which they have a pseudo-MHD
right.
Simulation in which they claim to see suppression of diffusion.
Right. I agree with you. They do not, however, they do not solve, you know, the fluid equations in that. That's, if you, well, that's some kind of statement about sort of field line, basically following field lines that wiggle somehow. But I mean, somehow F equals MA is not clear to me where that enters that story. I think, by the way, one of the things that I'm pestering Fausto and others on is this question. It really would be interesting to see sort of a good solid job, much like Fausto and David's work on alpha, on the question of beta. I think it would be, you know, it seems to me an obvious next priority for our friends doing computing.
You just, one of your slides mentioned Kim analysis.
Mm-hmm.
What is
your comment on that? It's basically a mean field electrodynamics type game where she took basically a set of forcings and she made some assumptions for the response to the forcings, some eddy damping time or whatever, and then went and calculated alpha and beta within that. So it's very similar to mean field electrodynamics, except instead of V being given in a sense, you're just saying the forcing is given. And, you know, there's a lot of algebra, and at the end of the day, the bottom line was she got the same alpha quenching factor that we did, and she got no quenching factor on beta. Okay. And it was published, I believe, in Physics Letters in 99, but I'm not...
Yeah. We did a bunch of simulations on... just coming out, or it will be coming out, actually, a 2D hyperactive number randomly forced MHC program, and the magnetic field grows up. And if it has a big enough initial amplitude, then it saturates the forcing. So you turn over from having eddies to having sort of things that look like quasi-alpha waves. And then, of course, once you're at that stage, you just don't have any diffusion. And that can happen completely independently of the magnetic resonance number because you just haven't got down to the magnetic, to the resistance scale by that time. So there's a quenching of the diffusion there. But if you try and look at what the diffusion is in the code, and look at the diffusion of a particle, you see diffusion, and that's because of along the field line, you start getting motions along the field. So it will randomly move around along the field line inside a box.
But the field, you're saying the field line itself does not move.
So it's cross-field diffusion that's suppressed.
But the field line itself, threading that particle,
well, in 2D, not really. Not in 2D.
Could I get...
So what happens is you see the motions go over to something that looks more like sort of alpha waves with a random magnetic field.
That's all 2D.
Yeah. If I could get my own advertisement in, I discovered that we have a series of five or six papers, and they're all a couple in PRL and a bunch in Physics of Plasmas, none in APJ, which is what everyone in this community reads. So I discovered some people aren't aware of them. If you want a stack of reprints, send me an email, and I will gladly send you a copy.
Just last question, why does it have to be a reaction of small fields and large fields? Why does it have to have form of diffusion?
They need not, no. I mean, basically, we are looking really at the restrictions on the spatial flux of magnetic potential, which out of tradition we write as a diffusion operator, but it need not have that form. In fact, there are off-diagonal effects, most notably the question of the hyperresistivity, in other words, related to the current gradient rather than the flux gradient. So there can be additional terms.
Especially if it behaves like a massive scale? Or
yes, 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 yes. So I was down to talk about numerical simulations or something. I think before giving any numerical results, it's worth thinking again. This is really just to re-emphasize, I suppose, what Pat has said, but I didn't know quite what he was going to say, about why alpha should or should not be suppressed and the level of the mean field at which that might happen. So as Pat has pointed out, alpha is it's a transport coefficient, is quite a good way of thinking about it, as of course is beta, the turbulent diffusion. And so a much cleaner problem, a much easier problem, is the turbulent diffusion of a magnetic field in the plane, where you can actually almost show things rigorously. In particular, you can relate the large scale, the energy of the large scale field to the energy of the small scale field by a factor which really is Rn in two dimensions. But the picture that you have is if you started, for example, you have a randomly stirred flow with maybe a large scale field, possibly no net flux, that's not really important. The motions...
I have to stop you. That's not correct. Formula, you mean? That formula is not correct. You can't make sense. It can't make sense. If you take the case in which the magnetic field strength is really, really large...
Oh!
No, it just never gets to the resistance.
Absolutely. I agree.
So this point, okay.
For weak fields, I'm not interested in the case. Of course, I can put in a whacking great field; it will decay ohmically. I didn't know anyone was interested in that here.
No, but in a case where you start and you wind up the field, if the magnetic Reynolds number is very big, before the field even gets to the resistive scale, it's strong enough to suppress the turbulence. And then there's no relationship between the mean field and B square.
Okay, all right.
So this would be a conditional
yeah, okay.
Yes. Okay. Could I make another comment along the same line? Suppose B bar is zero. Your formula says that whatever Rm is, B squared av is zero, which is nonsense. I can inject B squared at any wave number I wish. The formula cannot be correct.
Okay, well, let me consider this to be, you know, the largest scale you can fit in your box, then. Or let me talk about the problem where I impose a B. Let me talk
B
about...
B bar, you mean?
Yeah, if you want.
Okay, but the particular case, B bar equals zero, is of some interest.
Yeah, but, well...
You see what I'm trying to say? Does everybody understand what I'm saying? That formula implies that the turbulent B is zero if the average B is zero.
Okay, let me read it.
In steady state with no forcing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, George, let me. Okay, let me relate this to some very large scale within the box. Okay, and let the. Well, okay, the. What you say is not right, in that the diffusion, I will show you, the turbulent diffusion of a magnetic field with zero mean is affected in just a way consistent with that formula. So let us suppose we have a weak, large-scale field in the box, such that we can shred it to small scale, such that that is true. But of course, the problem is that on a small scale you then have a dynamically active field, whereas you still on a large scale have a weak field. That is the whole essence behind this problem. And one way, quite a good way I think, of thinking about it, is to look at, I mean, if you think of turbulent diffusion as, I should have written this up, you know, the classical whatever it is, d by dt of psi squared, where psi is the Lagrangian displacement of particles, that's probably G.I. Taylor formula, then you can think of suppression of diffusion as in some way suppressing the tendency of fluid elements to random walk. And this, taken from a paper of Catania's, are the trajectories of a number, can't remember how many, a number of particles, all with their center moved to the same place, so that you can compare them. 100, it says there. In a purely kinematic case, and in a case with what this number that he calls m squared, which is the ratio, get this the right way around, the ratio of u squared over b squared, this has a mean field, okay. Non-zero mean with u squared over b squared 30. Okay, so m squared equals infinity is this case. Okay, u squared over b squared 30 is still in some sense quite a weak field. The field, of course, there is a weak field in this direction. And you can see that there is, you know, tremendous suppression.
So that's in 2D? Only in 2D?
Absolutely, Arky. As I said, in 2D. Yeah.
So why do we keep discussing 2D? Because it's totally different from 3D.
I'm talking about 2D because I think it's important to talk about, I mean, my own feeling is that a useful way of thinking about alpha and beta is in terms of the Lagrangian description. Now, there are no calculations of magnetic, sensible ones of magnetic suppression, diffusion suppression. It's much harder in 3D, and anyway, we're talking about alpha. So I'm talking about the 2D case because I thought it might be instructive. Well, that's your view, which you're obviously entitled to. No, because I don't...
I think it'd be interesting to solve one problem. So if we can solve this one...
I think it is instructive. I think... Okay. So
I just might point out that if you run down the problems, both are concerned, in a sense, with calculating flux. Both are a transport process, and both have a kind of, for lack of a better word, magnetic topological constraint on them. One felicity conservation, one psi squared conservation. So there is, in fact, a great deal of commonality between the two.
I'm not saying that this has anything to do with magnetic diffusion in 3D. I never said that. I'm saying that both turbulent diffusion and alpha can be regarded as turbulent transport coefficients. And it's instructive, at least to me, and possibly to somebody else, if you think about them in their suppression in terms of how the tendency, the Lagrangian tendency of particles to random walk, in the case of diffusion, is suppressed at small scales.
Yes, but that tendency is completely gone in 3D. You might see fans go around each other, a possibility that doesn't exist in 2D.
I agree. I agree. For those of you who think this is, you know, don't want to listen to this, don't listen.
Sorry for the interruption, but I thought we might put a little bit more emphasis on 3D. But go ahead. I don't want to interrupt.
Okay. I mean, I can launch into alpha. I mean, not everyone here is an expert like you on the alpha effect, Arky. As far as I know, I thought this was kind of, you know, a discussion meeting. And so for those of people that may be wondering what all the fuss is about, why Blackman and Field write paper after paper saying Catania and Hughes are talking nonsense, why people from the outside might like to get in onto this argument, I thought this might be a way in.
Right side, you get excited.
I say that, go on.
A fact I still believe. So, still on 2D. This, okay. So this is the proof, if you like. That is the, let me explain what this is. This is a different calculation to that one. This has no mean field. Okay? The initial conditions, this is a calculation where of randomly stirred 2D turbulence. And the initial condition is like a sine mode or something. So no mean field through the box. Line A is purely kinematic. So that is what you might call a turbulent diffusion. Okay? And line F up there is purely ohmic. Okay, that's the ohmic time scale for the box. And these lines, B, C, D, and E, offer this M squared parameter, the ratio of U squared over B squared, where that B, I mean the amplitude of the initial K equals 1 component, right, goes, decreases. So M squared equals infinity is kinematic. It goes 200, 150, 30. Okay, so even here, the field is weak to some extent, but the diffusion time is, you know, considerably enhanced. Okay. So that is a case of a zero mean field in the box. So what else might we learn about transport coefficients? Well, another calculation that we've done, which is not to do with alpha, but is to do with transport, is to consider how a kinematic dynamo, what is a flow which is a fast kinematic dynamo, how is that, what happens to that flow when the dynamo becomes non-linear? So in particular, the flow we looked at was the famous Galloway-Proctor flow, which is of that form, so it's two-dimensional in the sense that psi is a function of x, y, and t, and looks something like, the famous Galloway, and the not at all famous Proctor flow. This will go on the web, won't it? which is this thing.
I'm a good lawyer.
So that flow has lots and lots of chaos in it, and in fact it has this much. These are the Lyapunov exponents, finite time Lyapunov exponents for that flow. Okay, so it stretches in two directions in the x and y plane, and it looks like this. Now when that flow's dynamo saturates, it could do lots of things, right? It could turn down the amplitude, or it could diffuse more, or it might do something more subtle, which is to suppress, essentially, the stretching. And I should have mentioned that in that diffusion case that we looked at, that I just showed earlier, that it is something more subtle. It's not that the whole flow suddenly goes, bleh, I've had enough. No, if you look at like the kinetic energy of the flow, you know, or any Eulerian property of the flow, it's still churning away, it still looks like a mess. Its diffusion is suppressed in rather a subtle way, which is why looking at the Lagrangian properties, I feel, is important. This one? No, it's a low Reynolds number calculation where the... That's not how it's done. You could think of it that way. It's a low Reynolds number calculation where we have a prescribed flow, namely that one, and an induced flow driven by the Lorentz force, which we can split because we make the assumption of low Reynolds number.
So you put on a force that would do...
Well, we don't actually, but we could.
Could you tell us what you actually do?
Yeah. We have a prescribed flow, this one.
Yes.
And an induced flow.
How do you separate the two conceptually?
By making an assumption that the Reynolds number, not the magnetic Reynolds, the Reynolds number is small. Mm-hmm. So then you can split the momentum equation. You can split the momentum equation formally into bit driven by force, bit driven by Lorentz force. The low Reynolds number, absolutely. You could just force the whole thing, actually, which is you can force the whole thing. My but you don't need to calculate it. But my graduate student has actually done that. But this is what we did. I mean, the pictures are more or less the same.
Can you represent on the slide here?
Ah, right. These are this is the stretching properties, if you like, the Lyapunov exponents measured for that flow. So you go into the box. So it only stretches in two directions, of course. We go into the box, essentially put, you know, however many particles along, and just evolve, you know, work out the stretching of the thing that started in the top left, so to speak, and color code it, and then just work all the way through. So particles that started here get stretched. So all the yellow and orange are regions of great stretching, and the blue regions are essentially integrable regions.
You were talking about mean field dynamos.
Yes.
And you're not anymore.
No, I'm not. You're right. I'm doing this to talk about transport.
Yes, all right.
Yes.
Yes,
thank you. You're absolutely right.
And also to demonstrate...
I did this because Pat suggested it, and now look what a mess I'm in.
To demonstrate memory.
Yeah, absolutely. That's why I'm doing it. You're right.
People who are not experts.
Thank you. Yeah. And I couldn't get onto my machine at home, so I don't have the equivalent snazzy colour one, so I had to take the not so snazzy black and white one from the paper. So this is the snazzy colour one, not so good. And this is on the same grey scale, the what happens in the nonlinear regime. Okay? So this little bit of black here and here are the only places in the flow. Of course, if you did it at different times, you'd get different pictures, but not different, you know, not different amounts of stretching. So what is clear is that the way this dynamo decides to switch itself off is not by going for drastic suppression of the kinetic energy. That is not what happens. That's a kind of theoretical possibility, but that is not what happens. It still looks like a turbulent mess, much more of a turbulent mess than the kinematic. In an Eulerian description, you know, this thing is immensely simple in an Eulerian manner. It's just a load of cells which go round and round. In the dynamical regime, the flow in an Eulerian sense is horribly messy. But what has happened, of course, is that its Lagrangian properties have been drastically suppressed. Okay. So that's just another way of another.
So the original flow has this very simple spatial structure, which is one of those. And does the induced flow have whatever spatial structure it wants, or do you just project out?
Oh, it has whatever structure it wants in this direction. This one is actually projected out simply onto the Z-independent. My student has extended these, actually. The results on suppression are still work if you make it more. So it has full scope to do whatever it wants in that flow. Okay. So now we can get onto 3D. So Archaea's left.
Why is there such a difference? I understood that there was an evolution between the
this one and this one. This one is purely kinematic.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And of course, kinematic flow must be stretching. Well, I mean, stretching is a good thing for a fast dynamo. So this is to say, what is it when you suppress, when you saturate? Sorry, not suppress. When you saturate the fast. What is a fast kinematic dynamo? What are the properties of the flow that have changed?
So here you have a background of the
magnetic
field.
Yeah. So I mean,
David, you might want to comment on the shades of gray and what they mean for the Athanor
X-rays. Oh yeah, sorry. I mean, these are like, you know, on the original picture, these were the kind of blue bits which were not stretching at all. They're just integrable regions of no stretching, and essentially the whole of the domain becomes that. But I mean, that was, in a way, an aside, just to kind of illustrate this business of the magnetic field giving the fluid some memory, essentially. If the particles kind of remember where they are, then they're not very good at separating exponentially, of course. So in 3D, I'll put up a formula which people will say is wrong. Given all the... We'll take it as read that all those things have been said. And there is a relation which is not so easy to derive analytically, since that is not possible. relating though the small scale to the strength of the small scale to the strength of the large scale, and there is some number here which presumably depends on. I mean, Catania and Weinstein originally said that number was even greater than one. I'm not sure that that is. Yes, I don't think that is true. All that matters, of course, is all that matters is what is that it's not zero. Yes. Yeah, I mean there is evidence from, that's right, Tao, Catania, Proctor, Kim, Uncle Tom Copley, that this number, well, for that flow, that number is like 0.15. Yeah, but it's easy to get it higher just by making the flow a bit more messy. So there is some evidence of you know, that is a nice order one number, and that's all that matters.
N is,
yes. And the equivalent formula to this one, this was for beta, this is the turbulent diffusion in terms of movement of Lagrangian displacement is this formula, derived by Moffat, I think, first of all, which relates alpha to Lagrangian displacement of fluid particles. So again, if you've got a weak, the physical picture, as I see it, is that if you've got a weak large-scale field, you could still have a strong small-scale field, which gives the fluid an enhanced memory. And the fact that it's 3D, yeah, you can say in 3D you can do different things, but my feeling is that, you know, because the motions which drive this are so complicated, that the small-scale field will have an effect, will enhance the memory of the fluid, and will suppress alpha.
Is enhanced memory equivalent to alpha degradation?
I suppose so, yes. In some sense. In some sense, yes. Yeah. Yeah. So...
The diffusion must come into the picture. Because otherwise our own...
Well, I mean, the other piece of the puzzle is the question of magnetic topology. Which is what makes the difference in alpha and beta.
I mean, you just couldn't be that B squared was a hell of a lot bigger than B squared, right? And B squared doesn't appear in this photo.
Sorry, I missed that.
I mean, that formula, if you had a very large RF, that formula says that B squared is the fluctuating B squared is very, very large for moderate mean field.
Mm.
But it couldn't be bigger than B squared.
No, I agree, of course, because that's right. I mean, that's the kind of argument that you're using. You say only up to B squared, and after that, you're stuffed.
That's what RF is. What do you mean by RF? What velocity is it taking?
No, you're right. But I mean, but in a sense, that is the argument. That is the whole point. That you can get small scale fields much stronger than the large scale fields. If the small scale fields become comparable to U squared before you reach diffusive cutoff, then you can have enhanced diffusion. No, enhanced diffusion time.
If you were doing mean field electrodynamics in the regime of magnetic energy much bigger than fluid energy, you'd probably want to express alpha in terms of the B tilde and K tilde.
I'm not even thinking of doing that. I'm saying as the magnetic energy grows, it saturates B squared at some point. Time. If your magnetic Reynolds number is 10 to the 18, as it might be in the galaxy, right?
Mm.
That happens when the mean field is 10 to the 18 times energy, is 10 to the 18 times smaller, take n equals 1. That's phenomenal. That's incredible. Your seed fields are much bigger than that. This is entirely an irrelevant regime.
Well, we have to be a bit careful here. I mean, about... No, I mean, if the galaxy were full of 2D turbulence, I'm absolutely sure that result is right.
It's not. Even with 2D turbulence, you couldn't have B squared bigger than B squared. It can't be such a relation. Your relation doesn't relate B squared and B squared. It only relates B squared and mean B squared.
Yeah, but it says...
be what you said it was. RM is based on some velocity field, which isn't the velocity field you would have in this hypothetical situation.
No, if the velocity field were all in half angle, right? It's sort of a velocity field.
Is there an assumption of partition between the gamma and the mu?
Well, okay, the argument is, you know, if you considered a series of, you know, thought experiments starting from infinitesimally weak fields and increasing the strength of the large scale field, right? So at the extreme, you have a purely kinematic field, right? No back reaction. Then that decays on something, you know, on a well-defined turbulent decay time, yeah? Now you make it dynamic, okay? If the field, you can always make the field weak enough that still holds, okay? But at a critical strength of the large-scale field, the small-scale field is sufficiently strong that it is in roughly equipartition with, you know, the energy-containing eddies. Okay. Well, at that stage, then you're kind of in trouble. Or at least it matters. Right? At that stage. I mean, you shake your head. There is numerical, you know. I mean,
I don't believe any of this.
No. But I'll explain why. Right, but, well, maybe I could ask you this, because, you know, I know you've written a lot of papers saying, several. Yeah, just a couple saying. Well, you've written a few saying that what we've done is wrong. So, I mean, do you think that the simulations are wrong, just out of interest? Well, no, I mean, George is sitting there shaking his head. I'd like just for my own peace of mind.
Well, these points will come up, but I think the thing to do would be to present the simulation.
Well, these aren't, okay, I mean, these aren't even mine.
It's my fault.
No, it's not your fault. No, but, I mean, these aren't mine. I have no vested interest. These are Catania's. But can I ask George, do you think Catania's simulations are wrong?
No, isn't they not relevant to the physical problem because they're in a closed box? And all of these arguments are basically traced back to helicity conservation. And helicity conservation is indeed a very crucial point here. The alpha effect does in fact produce helicity, and if it does not escape, it has to be dissipated. That places a very strong constraint on the alpha.
Well, no, we're talking about 2D diffusion here. I mean, there's no...
Okay, I'm sorry.
On the subject of what Mike was getting at, with what D you use, I think for that formula in 2D, it's helpful to interpret R sub M as a kind of Nusselt number for the magnetic flux. So that includes both the question of the V and, for lack of a better word, the phase relations aside, which is,
yes,
in a sense what we're getting,
yes,
at in all.
Yes, yes. That's sort of the problem that I was
wondering. Yeah, but I mean, that's why, but you, in a
then
sense,
it doesn't mean anything because we don't know what it is.
Well, the question is, what can you get out at the end of the day?
I'm a bit neutral on the results of the 2D simulations because they are 2D, but the one comment that I have about the RM thing is that derived, it seems like that's when the kinematic regime is violated as opposed to,
yeah,
the regime when it necessarily means,
well,
in other words, if you have a system which evolves to some steady state, that's not necessarily telling you the relationship between the mean field and the functional field in the same state, but that's telling you when you have to worry about the back reaction.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's a fair way of saying it. Yeah.
Okay, so
I would agree with that.
So we would agree with that.
Yeah.
The 2D
That's a fair way of saying it. But I mean, you say the arguments are irrelevant, then you have to explain that picture.
Well, I would say that... Well,
that was to answer Stephen's question. So that means that you can still have a large-scale field, which is of the order of magnitude that we observe. So maybe, as Eric said,
yeah,
this relationship holds until the kinematic regime breaks down at a smaller scale, mm-hmm, and from then on you can increase maybe the mean field.
It's not a relationship that's...
Well, wait. On the one hand, we're talking about 2D diffusion, and now you're introducing the mean field, and now you've introduced observations. I mean, observations...
Let's just,
yeah, but
go back to that point. The point is that the RM versus RM mean field versus the B-square relationship, I think it marks the point at which one has to worry about the back reaction of the mean field rather than any statement about a saturated state. And that,
yeah,
you agree with that.
I'd agree with
so
that.
And I agree with that. Everyone seems to agree,
yeah,
with that.
So there's no disagreement with observation.
I don't think we should muddy the waters with observations either, really. I mean, if you're trying to tie this to observations of the galaxy, I think that's just a joke.
We should cherish the...
There is a well-defined theoretical problem in MHD turbulence. You can argue that the alpha effect's a waste of space, if you want, but that is, again, is another argument. I mean, people have been using this for 30 years. There is a well-defined problem in MHD turbulence, which is, what is the suppression of the alpha effect? I mean, you're not going to answer it by looking at the galaxy.
Well, true, agreed with all that, but I think this point about the RM, at least there's some minor divergence.
Sure, sure, but I mean, that, you know, throwing the galaxy in is just kind of a red herring.
In 2D simulations, I'm neutral on them, only because of 2D, not because they're not interesting. I mean, I think they're interesting. It's just that if one wants to then go and translate this to the question of the galaxy, we both would agree that there's another that it has to be considered, that some of the topics may be important. It's just that I wouldn't criticize the results of the 2D simulations.
Well, I mean, the comment was made that it's all something. I'm not quite sure what the comment was. I mean, you either say Catania can't do the simulations, which is, you know, if that's what you're saying, then you have to do it properly yourself. Or else you explain this. This has to be explained.
I'm sorry, I thought you were talking about 3D, and then we suddenly switched back.
I haven't even got to 3D. Well, okay. Well, I put that thing up, right.
You were lucky to get beyond
1D. Lucky to get beyond 1D, yeah. Right, 3D. Okay. Well, I can tell you what. I mean, there are a few simulations of suppression of alpha in 3D, and they're not, what can I say, they're not easy because alpha is a mess. I mean, one way you could do simulations of the alpha, calculations of alpha in 3D, and we have done, I mean, we have looked into this, is that you can, you know, if you have an immense computational box with a genuine separation of scales, then you could measure how the largest scale field in your box is related to the small, you know, the U cross B on the small scales. And typically those are messy. I'll show you in a bit. What we did, on the other hand, was to take, this thing. He's still equally famous, Galloway and Proctor Plow.
Thank you. Kind.
In a box with a fully 3D calculation forced. Okay, so it's different to those things I talked about before. So we have a box, and this is scaled, there's no gravity, but the vertical scale is the mode of maximum growth rate of the Galloway-Proctor flow. In kinematic theory, it just grows. The flow is 2D. Okay. I mean, it has all three components, but depends on only two of them. It grows and it saturates. Okay. Now, what is the separation of scales in this thing? Well, obviously none at the moment because, you know, everything, here we are with a box. Okay. I mean, we could have a few of these boxes, which we have actually done, but even that's a messy calculation. Really, you want zillions of these boxes. The other thing, of course, to do is what, you know, goes back to Moffat. If you really want to calculate alpha, the argument is that, you know, on a small scale, it doesn't really matter whether you've got an imposed infinite scale field, okay? On the small scale, that's what you see. So the calculations we do are to put in an imposed B naught, not necessarily vertical, but let's talk about the vertical case here, and to use as our separation of scales this scale and this scale. So this one is infinite, has an infinite scale, and hence is large in some sense, whereas this has a finite scale, and so is small. So there is a true separation of scales. It really is, there's nothing in between. It really is, the classical alpha effect. Okay? And once it's dynamic, of course, the flow is fully 3D. Okay? So we have a small scale field and flow, and a large scale field, and we can look at the correlation between those two, which is really what you mean by an alpha effect. Okay? But it's messy. Okay? That's why if you just go into a calculation and pick a few points, they can be all over the place. Okay? Really, to do this calculation properly, you should have millions of these boxes if you wanted just to do it over a short period. Otherwise, because it's an ensemble average, otherwise you say that, you know, you invoke the fact that the correlation, there is a finite correlation time for this flow, and you take long time averages, okay, which is the same as doing, you know, a vast array of these things, but obviously much cheaper. And you can see, you know, it is the answer. Okay, this is alpha versus time for one imposed field.
Where's the forcing again?
It's the forcing that drives the Galloway Proctor flow. So it's dT minus nu
del square u, where u is that thing over there. Okay. And this one is force, genuinely force.
U is two-dimensional,
or what? No, okay. The forcing drives a 2D flow. Right, the forcing drives the Galloway plot to flow.
And I've got result B-naught. I mean, what is alpha?
Well, alpha is only related to B naught.
So it's no felicity in what you drive. I just don't know.
Right. This is okay. Well, the flow actually is a red herring as well. We took the flow because we've done other work on the flow. Let me explain. Let me explain. Because I could have just said we took a nasty flow, which a messy forcing, which gave us this 3D flow, which is all that really happened. We took this forcing because we took this flow because we'd done other work with it. But in 2D, in the kinematic regime, it's 2D. There is no alpha effect as we define it in 2D, because the velocity field has no z dependence. There is no small scale velocity field. So there's no alpha effect. So the kinematic regime of this dynamo is of no relevance whatsoever to everything I'm saying. It evolves through kinematic growth and saturation into a mess. Okay?
You mean into the third dimension?
Yeah, into a messy flow. Of course, it must be three-dimensional. And at that stage, we have a flow which is z-dependent, x, y, and z, and time-dependent. It's a mess. It happens to be driven by this force, which happens to drive a nice kinematic dynamo. But that is irrelevant, except that it gave us this nice flow. Okay, which we knew it would, but it's not really related to why it was, to why Galloway and Proctor took it or anything. At that stage, we have this messy flow. Okay, we can impose a field through the box, okay, and correlate U cross B with the imposed field. Yeah.
If you don't have the field, the flow stays 2D.
No.
Why is that an induced?
Because it saturates. It's only 2D. It's 2D as a kinematic dynamo. So when the magnetic field is infinitesimal, formally infinitesimal, okay, it's a 2D flow. The field amplifies exponentially.
But we do put in a small.
Oh yeah. And then it saturates.
Okay.
And at that stage we can start talking about this calculation. It's just
so it was
another. Yeah. Uh-huh. That's right. Once we're in the messy 3D state. Yeah. That's right.
Okay.
It's just a way of getting a nice messy flow that we had sitting around. We could, but it's not really related to how we got there. Just we knew it would give us, we knew it would get there quickly and give us one. So we took it. But you can see that, measuring, you have to be careful when you measure alpha, because suppose you just went in and said, oh, I'll measure it here. Well, then here, you get completely the wrong answer. You didn't get the wrong sign. Okay. So even that this is the running mean. Okay. And these are the three. This is like alpha 3-3, alpha 2-2, and alpha 1-1. When the field is in the z direction, there is only an alpha 3-3. So the point is that you must be careful in any numerical claim of an alpha effect. You have to be very careful what it is that you're talking about, because you can see that if you just went into this run at the wrong point, you'd get completely the wrong answer. Okay, but you can also see, I hope, that there is a well-defined long-term mean. So the question is, what does it depend on? Okay, well, there's two parameters in this problem, B naught and RM. As Eric said, people, take a formula of this form. That might be completely wrong. Let us assume for the moment that it's not. So the question is, how well do the results fit that formula? So you can vary B naught, which is easy, or you can vary RM, which is a pain, because you really like to go to immense RMs, which is impractical. Varying B naught is easy. Okay, so this is This is, okay. So normalized means normalized with the kinetic energy or with the velocity originally. So this is, these are the numerical results from long time averages like that one I just showed you of alpha against B naught squared. No, I think it's normalized with like the kinetic energy of the Galloway pop flow.
Well, is there some systematic stuff where you're comparing when you have simulations
that are different key knots, they have the kinetic energy saturates different levels? The kinetic energy of the final flow is comparable to the kinetic energy. There isn't a drastic suppression of kinetic energy in the saturated state. Yeah, but I mean, I couldn't care less about the normalization. That's not relevant. Yeah, I mean, if this number was 17.8, it would just be another normalization. So, I mean, all that matters is whether, is how, I mean, okay, I should say what I fitted at this point. I mean, this curve, alpha naught over 1 plus b squared, the dashed, and the solid curve, alpha naught over 1 plus rmb squared, have been fitted at that point only. Okay, they agree at that point. And we would contend that one curve fits the data better than the other, though that is not universally accepted.
I think that's not really the question, though. Okay.
What is the question then, Arky?
The question is whether the need to feed concept is interesting.
No, that's another question. That's a completely different question. That's a very interesting question. I agree.
And that's the one we don't agree on. I mean, everyone agrees on that.
Oh, no. No, they don't. No, they don't. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. And the other thing that you can do is measure the dependence on Rm. If indeed there is an Rm dependence. That's the result. Those are the numerical results, and that's. Oh, this one is actually for a horizontal field. And we get the horizontal field imposed that the exponent is 0.74. It turns out for vertical field, the exponent is 1.2. I mean, the number is neither here nor there in some sense. The number is obviously. And you'd expect, in our case, different numbers for the z and the x and y because they're not the same. The forcing is not isotropic.
Is that a little worrisome then? Because it's not a completely arbitrary background flow, and it matters what direction it is with respect to the
field. No, it's not worrying at all. I'd be amazed if it was the same. The flow, the Z is preferred in the flow. The forcing is dependent only on X and Y. So I'm not at all surprised. Yeah, but it's still. Well, it's still forced. It's still forced all the time by a flow which is by a force which is said independent. So yeah, absolutely. So I mean, would have been more worrying if it had been the same. And I think this number is going to change. You know, depends what you have. The value of the number is neither here nor there. It just depends whether it's naught. So we, again, would argue that there is a Reynolds number dependence and that the number is not naught. Seems to be
point. Isn't Eve's point not so much about the difference in those numbers, but in that if you have an inherent anisotropy in your flow, then even in the absence of any B naught, you could get a non-zero value of B cross B. Right? To get V cross B average, not zero, you need some anisotropy. And it seems like you may have...
In the forcing profile, you should.
But there are plenty of other examples of isotropic forces. I don't think that's it.
Yeah.
But that's a
problem.
You're doing it on purpose and wanting to see how it falls away. You're putting in an alpha. You're putting in something that would give you a non-zero B plus B at the beginning and then seeing how it fits.
Of course, I mean, that's the game.
I'm not sure if that makes sense as possible.
question of curiosity. What is there any lore on the effects of critical layers in alpha, which would be analogous to what we're thinking of resonance effects, which are roots to dissipation without explicit dependencies on coefficients and so forth, sort of in the spirit of Landau damping?
What was the critical layer?
Basically, a resonance between the flow speed and the fluctuation phase velocity. Sort of like the layer in that Kelvin Helmholtz. Where the cat's eye sits, you know, in a ferrolaminar case.
Yeah, but I'm just putting up that. I think it's not somewhat
long term. And you're looking for a little shear.
What?
What do you have in mind?
Yeah, on the basket. Yeah, but I mean, one could even revisit just sort of turbulent shear flows with such a thing.
Oh, sure. Well, I'm more or less done. Yeah.
Can we see what is the last one you didn't fit with the gamma, right?
I'm sorry?
The last one you didn't fit with the gamma. There's a big naught difference, but there was no coefficient, right?
It was one, actually, as it happened.
It went R into the one, in that
case. Yeah, that's right. You can get it even better, actually. Because it's a different... Yeah, this one actually is a horizontal field, and the other one was a vertical field. Turns out, I mean, you've got two parameters to play with. We actually just chose... We could have made that fit even better. We chose 1 over 1 plus RMB squared, so gamma was 1. The optimal fit is gamma slightly bigger than 1, as it happens. Yeah, very serious.
I'm going to bring it to the machine room. The mean of the B squared.
Okay.
This is about 1,000 feet, nothing else, okay. Actually, okay, between 1,000 and 20%.
Okay.
And with increasing magnetic Reynolds number, the level increases slightly. Yes, there's absolutely no tunnel.
But this, what you're talking about,
that's not a statement about scale.
Yeah, you're just saying that this quantity.
That one, yeah.
Okay, what about then? What about this quantity?
But you know, we have a net vanishing in field.
So the best you could do is talk about a long wavelength.
Okay.
A certain box like cable.
Yeah, you could talk about B1 squared.
Okay.
The low wave number.
B1 squared, okay. And what is, how is that? That you force on, say, K equals half
of that? Invariably find is that the spectrum of B squared and U squared will pass out.
Where so forcing the sort of forcing is at what scale, please?
In this case, forcing is at K equals half.
Yeah. Okay, and that's true even if you have helicity, kinetic helicity, even with ABC flow.
Yes.
No, but this makes sense because the forcing interval sort of makes sense in this picture that this is the forcing scale, and in a way the dynamo is asking about what's happening over here. So the mean field dynamo is asking about what's happening on scales with K less than forcing scale.
In another case, we have K equals 2.
Mm-hmm. So you've made a break?
Yeah, one
third.
Uh-huh. And what is left?
Well, Eric is left.
You're left. And
actually. You, and Dr.
Actually, yeah.
And one third.
At K equals 2, one gets. You'd expect to have about twice as fast a growth because you have half as small a box. But in fact, you get about four times as fast a growth. And the reason is that the field likes to break the symmetry. So instead of having actually eight replicas of the cable one box, you end up having eight replicas of the velocity field, but the magnetic field develops a cable with one component, and the topology sort of wanders through all eight boxes, and this seems to be beneficial for the growth. So the growth is twice as fast as that. And if you then go to, we also go up to K equals 3 and K equals 4, and then the growth rate follows K. So 3 is 50% larger than 2, and 4 is double twice as fast as 2.
But what happens to the spectra in those cases? Because mean field dynamo theory predicts an inverse cascade of the magnetic energy.
Yeah, and scale associated.
I think I could even go back and find these data sets online. Actually look at these and get the power spectra. I'll try and do that in the afternoon here.
Sure. Okay.
Yeah.
Meneguzzi did a crude experiment of this type in the 80s, and he found that as time went by, magnetic energy decreased.
Yes, I think that will.
I think that might be consistent with what you see.
Except it won't become higher than the kinetic energy. I would expect to become higher.
It does. It becomes a force-free field in the Pouquet calculation in 1976.
Well, that's the other thing I wanted to tell you about, which is in this thesis, that this guy made another set of simulations where if you just skip the cosines in the energy flow,
Well,
you get something that has a vanishing mean field.
Yeah.
And in that case, growth is even faster. Right. And it saturates as a laminar equilibration dynamo. So even though we have a kinetic Reynolds number which is high, so that it becomes turbulent, we start with a very, very weak field. And after some time, the flow becomes turbulent. But the growth of the magnetic energy keeps on elevating until it saturates. At that point, turbulence shuts off, and the flow becomes laminar again, with U parallel to B, and the two equal. So then you have almost exactly the condition.
Yes.
So in this case, the flow with vanishing elasticity grows faster, actually, than the other one.
Huh.
And the reason is pretty obvious when we look at what actually happened to the feed lines, namely that in the, and it might be sort of coincidental or atypical, the problem with this particular helical flow, the ABC flow, is that it has too many symmetries. It is very symmetric. No? Mm. It has a number of symmetries. And that makes it difficult for the field lines to...
So it doesn't actually act in a random walk? Or
no, exactly. The growth rate for the ABC flow at K+1 is actually very low. Compared to the local strain rate, the maximum of the local strain rate is square root of 2, 1.4. And the actual growth rate is 0.07.
Hmm.
So it's 20 times smaller than that. So I think that's the reason in this case.
Mm-hmm.
But there doesn't seem to be anything particular about at least total release. Local is
it's
what we are trying to accomplish with a very simple simulation tackle is to achieve a turbulent state.
Mm-hmm.
And my student has found that if he imposes a Z-independent ABC flow, it doesn't really become turbulent.
No.
And so he has found a way of making it turbulent, just the molar spectrum and so on. Mm-hmm. And I think that's important because that's the case, the only case as far as I know, that the theory of alpha omega dynamos applies to.
Mm-hmm. How does he do that?
He does it by introducing a counter ABC flow.
Time-dependent?
I think it's time-dependent.
Yeah.
Two flows hit each other and annihilate their symmetries and become chaotic very quickly.
Right. Yes. Yeah. I think any type of forcing you do that doesn't have too much symmetry.
Right.
Will very quickly be like a Conover of like turbulent state.
Right.
And it's my experience that if you have 128 cubed or 256 cubed, you can find a whole power of 10 of inertial range.
Right.
That should be enough.
I think so.
I mean, who cares about having 5?
No. Right.
And even having just not even a discernible inertial range, the qualitative properties of the flow are the same in 32 cubed, actually.
Mm. They are.
You can't really see the inertial range, but you know, qualitatively it looks the same. So I don't think there would be any tremendous difficulties in that.
The reason, so therefore,
these experiments are totally affordable today. Lots of experiments. One could really play around.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Unfortunately, my student is computer trained.
But even on workstation, it should be okay.
Well, he doesn't find that he's okay. He's working on a parallel machine with 6 processors.
Okay.
But
how many? What's the resolution?
128.
Yeah. Okay.
He's using a pseudo spectral encoder.
Well,
it
should be
reasonable.
Yeah.
But what our intuition says, maybe I shouldn't speak for Eric, is that we don't understand how RM can enter any condition that is in. That is basically driven by the energy containing eddies, which don't know about RM.
No, exactly.
Because of the cascade.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is irreversible.
Yes.
So we have an intuition that RM shouldn't appear, but it does appear. And as far as I know, this is the first display of a graph showing the direct dependence on RM.
Yeah,
I
haven't seen that.
Which is exactly what I asked my student to do, and so he's got to find something else to do. What?
Right. Yeah, I was going to say, I agree with all the intuition. The one case which I thought sort of interesting that we have a lot of students that don't have a large prime number.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if you've done these simulations. I think you have done something like that. What happens if you have a large magnetic prime number and you start out with a small seed field? What happens to your color spectrum? Have you done that?
No, we haven't, but I believe that.
Okay. They have done it. Yeah, they find.
Yeah, I would. I'm not surprised at what they find.
You don't think that? You think it's surprising, or you think it's, do you think it's right? They have this thing that looks like this.
Right. Yeah.
This is a simulation.
Yeah.
By
Cowley and company.
Okay. Yeah.
So they got this.
The magnetic energy is building up towards the,
yeah,
the scale. And in that case,
well, the problem is that they're forcing at that. They don't have any.
Right, they don't have any inertia range. They're forcing like here.
Yeah. Oh, they are.
Yeah.
So that's questionable. But the,
so don't you think too that if they had really
simulation,
that's sort of what I would think too. So, or even if it's a really small, they might expect just to.
Why
would that, why is that a concern?
The only reason that that's a concern is because in that case, if it were really true, if, for example, that curve, when we went to saturation, since they haven't done this, we can't tell, but supposing that it did actually proceed all the way to the inertial range.
Yes.
Like, with in saturated state, even with it putting an energy in like this, it would end up piling up all those fields on a small scale, then the peak of the energy is in a regime that's determined by Rm. And that's the only reason why it's a concern, because there, then you begin to wonder whether Rm, what role it plays in that case.
Certainly.
The other thing actually is, though, it may be, I haven't asked them, but I'm thinking if they put in helicity into their forcing, whether that would drain energy from them to small scales up to larger scale. I don't know if they've actually put in helicity, forced their flows of helicity, you know, in this picture. So maybe that would actually clear.
No, I agree with you. If you go to different kinds of this, all gets wrong. Yeah.
But nevertheless, these guys are prime number one anyway, so
yeah.
So that doesn't apply.
I also have problems believing that it really is relevant to get these very high prime numbers. Because what they actually are saying is that it's really easy. The dissipation
of
the
line
is a sort of
number relay for you.
So
you just got to write it, which is pi.
Yeah.
For you.
Larger than astronomical unit, much, much larger. And if you apply their reasoning to the solar wind, that dissipation range would be about an astronomical unit, because that's the mean peak half.
Yeah.
But that's not the way it really works. Somehow the solar wind manages to become permanent.
I mean, Earth is a
That's where things become nonlinear.
I
I tend to agree with that. I always hesitate with these one-liners, but I tend to agree with that.
Yeah.
I think there's been replacement therapy.
Oh, yeah. No, I never the there's far too much writing of it down in reference to three dimensions, too, where it has zero relevance. And that's one thing we're not guilty of. You can't pin that on me. So. It seemed to me, at least talking with Eric this morning, there's been a certain amount of convergence.
Yeah, so I think so. Well, you must feel happy that these simulations that David discussed, you will do a theory, right?
Yeah, but I've been playing this game too long in life to get too happy over that.
Okay.
I'll feel happier when there are two or three simulations getting the same answer.
Yeah.
I understand what you guys are going on about, I think, now, at least part of it.
Okay.
And I'm interested in this idea of helicity injection.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, you know, where I'm totally ignorant is real astrophysics.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how do you make it work in reality?
Okay. Could you excuse me a moment?
Absolutely.
I want to continue this. Okay, the simplest, I think there are no electric fields along the B field in nature. It's true, very close to being ideal MHD. So it's not like a tokamak where you can put a gap and put an electric field along the B, right? Okay. Where then does simplicity come from? The answer is that the alpha dynamo is a helicity pump, which grabs helicity from a small scale and comes to a large scale.
Yeah. Alpha certainly is a subgrid scale model, if there ever was one.
Right. It keeps that up as long as there could be a dissipation or a loss of helicity, which counts for this flow. So the classical formula that forget who first produced it, but you have referred to it by making a lesson chapter, that alpha b squared is limited by dot l cross b, that is the small scale field. Is perfectly correct if there is no transfer of this across the boundary, which is what you
say. Violently agree.
Oh, okay. So I think wherever one uses that formula, one has to be careful about the boundaries.
Yes.
We actually agree with the results of their simulation.
You would agree in that in the limit of nothing funny coming in, right?
That's right. They test this relationship and find it in fact to be true. So in that sort of way, it's actually consistent. It's just a question of which problem that they're solving and how it applies to astrophysical settings. That's the way that I would phrase the disagreement.
Well, and there's also this problem. I find myself very painfully sometimes agreeing with Ake. How do you get from all this to explaining anything?
Oh, right.
It's really bad.
No, it's certainly true. I think this is a community where there's both mathematicians involved and from running a spectrum of mathematicians to astrophysicists.
There's mathematicians, there's clowns like me,
There's theoretical astrophysicists and phenomenologists.
That's right.
Thank God I had no observers. That would really speed things up. I mean, the sun, of course, looks very, very dangerous.
Yeah. It's sort of interesting how spatial resolution actually can hamper one's understanding, so to speak.
Somebody was mentioning the tendency to feel lines to come, which is an age-old problem posed by Parker, because you actually see that happening on the solar surface. So those spicules, or pores, they call them, are magnetic flows, and then they are observed to come together, and no one knows why. You think it's just a characteristic of an ancient
period? I think it's characteristic in certain moments, yes, but I would say the thing I'm thinking of is such a specialized limit, it has precious little to do with what goes on in the surface of the sun. I think I can explain it in 2D with large magnetic energy. I think there's a reasonable story there based on it's a certain subcase of the inverse cascade of psi square. It's very clear.
One thing you
can but in terms of the general cosmic meaning of it all, I'm hurting.
Are you saying something like what has been said about the red spot on Jupiter, that in a 2D flow like an atmosphere and the vortex lines tend to accumulate?
It's related to that, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, but it's a bit more specialized because you also have to allow for the opposite case if the fluid energy is sufficiently large, psi squares just pass a scalar. So it depends. Mm-hmm. It depends a bit on this energy imbalance.
Okay. In the sun, apparently what happens is that the flux lines accumulate until there is balance, that is, between the magnetic pressure and the magnetic pressure.
Well, that's interesting.
One thing that's, you can sort of see in steady state, if the average thermal particle pressure is significantly greater than the magnetic pressure, that's the case when you would really expect to get more flux tubes, because the volume filling fraction, every flux tube is a pressure balance, but if the average thermal pressure dominates the average magnetic pressure, then the volume filling fraction of the tubes is the small volume filling fraction of the overall region.
Yeah.
So you can at least imagine that if you had some instability that set up that situation from the beginning, that it might expect to stay that way.
Yeah, that's the case of the sun.
Right. But it's sort of an algorithm for when you would expect intermittency like this. Like if the plasma beta were 1, you would expect less. You would expect the field to be more volume filling. In fact, the ratio is in this naive estimate, it's 1/1 the filling factor. So beta twiddles 1/1 the magnetic field filling factor.
And that also works with the intersubmedia.
Yeah.
Where beta is constant.
Yeah.
Another thing that troubles me is, because I read material, and she just arbitrarily injects my energy in K-1, I don't feel constrained to relate the magnetic energy on small scales to that on an infinite scale. Hence my claim that formula could not be right, because you can surely have a case where V bar is 0.000.
But in the case you want to address, there's got to be additional pay plus an additional contribution due to the injection. In other words, the psi square balance will be transport versus dissipation plus injection. So you then could actually even take the limit of B0 goes to 0 as you would want to do and just balance dissipation and injection in a stationary state.
that's what Fouquet does. But she does it through a turbulent cascade. In other words, she injects a cable one, cascades to KD, and is dissipated. In 3D, what?
Right.
And there's no mean field at all.
Right.
So that formula can't be relevant.
Yes.
Yeah. Do you agree with me?
Yes, I would. Yeah. But all I'm saying is, I think that I agree. Again, I violent agreement. I mean that the case these guys are doing in the computation, there's no magnetic energy injection.
Right. Now it happens that the interstellar case, I think, probably corresponds more to the case that I'm discussing, because you inject a lot of energy at small scales, and maybe a small amount of energy at very large scales. Possibly a seed field on the scale of the galaxy, or possibly, as Eric has suggested, an expectation value of a mean field just due to the one of the square root of f of x. And we're not sure whether that is legitimate to interpret as a physical mean field.
So, Ellen, is this what you wanted, expected? No one's been murdered yet.
I said the most damning negative comment so far, but somebody else has got a
reason. It wasn't very ferocious.
What?
No, it really didn't turn out to be
it wasn't particularly ferocious.
Yeah. Neither your comment, no, nor in general.
I said I don't believe this.
Well, when David started going on about shaking his head,
I think this RF thing is somewhat of a misunderstanding also about what people meant by it too.
Because I
basically could agree that, as George was talking about, that this thing is, you know, that they can, it marks the point at which the kinematic regime is violated. And I said that he agreed with that fact.
That's true.
Well, actually,
he had written it as an apology.
I thought there was something else behind it. I thought it was this idea that that the field, organizes in thin layers.
But I guess it's a question.
Yeah.
And so.
I mean, the way in which we have it, the way in which it seems to be used in some places is that if you let the system evolve and you let the mean field do its thing from some dynamo and you let everything, the small scale field do its thing, and you let the thing go to saturation, there's been that's the impression that we thought that people might have interpreted that formula, that in other words, in the fully saturated state, this is the best you can do. B bar B, mean B is equal to RM little
B.
RM to minus half, or yeah. But that doesn't represent any saturated state. It only represents
presets the robot.
Where Chris begins to
it's saturated, and then you have to worry about nonlinear effects.
No, I mean, it's where it goes from exponential to polynomial growth. Is another way of putting it.
Okay. Well, Kant, arguably. But you were saying.
No, I was just going to say that that's the expression that people who do mean field models with alpha question. That's what they do.
But the whole thing, I mean, what he's written up there.
Solving mean field
models. But in the debate is, So in this case, certainly the debate is whether alpha gets suppressed by this, whether alpha, once this non-kinematic regime begins, whether alpha is killed off by that factor or not. But it's not.
What we find is p equals zero, and they find p is 0.7.
So you're going to address that in your.
Yeah. Well, actually, yeah. I mean, the point here is that, that it can come in as a suppression factor without any relationship between the mean and the fluctuated field. I mean, that's a separate question.
Sure.
If the RM comes into that formula, that's a separate question from whether or not B bar squared is equal to bar B squared.
That's where we got that.
Apparently,
by using the zone overview.
No, that's not, at least for us, that's not fair. We got it from velocity balance.
Yes.
We got it from the Zeldovich formula only in 2D.
Yeah, I don't think, I mean, I would say that, because...
I'm sorry, Daniel and Weinstein are...
Five
papers on this.
Agreed, okay. Agreed, but that's what I'm... Yeah.
They wrote it has to be B0 squared over little b squared, and that from Zeldovich is given by our head.
But yeah, I guess all I'm saying is that you can write down this formula, and this is not really a formula that refers to the desaturated state. This is just what happens. This equality only holds when you start to enter the fully nonlinear regime. But independent of that, you can try to derive the suppression on alpha from other ways, and it may be that the RM comes in, or may not be. It's independent of this relationship. And when we get this coming in, if you ignore this felicity flow. And that has nothing to do with ever assuming.
Oh, I know, that's the way they did it.
But yeah, that statement, though, Eric, is, I would argue, in a closed, stationary system.
Yeah.
That statement is a rigorous expression of psi square balance. Okay, if I interpret Rm as the Nusselt number, okay?
Yeah, no, you're right.
Yes.
By the way, apparently it was first derived by Proctor and Mott in a paper in 1989.
Isn't it really first derived by Zeldovich?
I don't think so. Did he have this felicity argument?
No, but for 2D MHD, I think he did, actually.
Hmm.
Okay, I'll check that. I have his
2D, yes,
but paper.
But the 3D...
It's not true that 3D...
Yeah.
Oh, that thing isn't true.
Okay.
You're saying the balancing alpha and eta b squared.
Right.
That may be, I'll have to check.
I didn't know this paper at all. When was it? And they got very close to saying this is an upper limit on alpha. Instead, they said, this is true, you ask Mike, the G, they have to be extremely small scales in the small scale field in order to dissipate this large Reynolds number. And then they computed the force, which they left at that, the limiting force would be large, quote unquote. But when you do that, you immediately realize that this little b cannot be part of a cascade. It's far larger than you would think from a cascade. Now maybe this is relevant to the high Prandtl number case.
Yeah.
That could dissipate elliptically. I don't know, that peak.
Fouquet is also banging on the door of this in her papers of the late 70s.
Oh, yeah.
But didn't quite.
Yeah. Well, the thing that I discovered belatedly after reading her 76 paper very often was that most of her diagrams are for the case Reynolds number equals 1 million.
Mm-hmm.
When she did a calculation of alpha, the turbulent diagram, the kinetic velocity and saw the magnetic velocity wrong and so forth. She had to get rid of the magnetic velocity somehow, and she chose Rm equals 30 in order to make it work. She doesn't explain why she had to pick a small Rm. Physics is that velocity is conserved, and therefore you have to get rid of it if you have a closed system.
Well, And you know, I remember you already ordered, I just remember that there were other results from higher order. I thought that was just a limitation. I thought that was just what they were doing.
What?
It was in the same situation.
Do you, is there any validity?
The way I look at it is felicity conservation.
With
small costs to begin with, forces a very large magnetic energy on a small scale, which then produced this big back reaction. It's a way of looking at it.
Yeah. Because in particular, it's ruled out because it would have to be inverse cascade of the energy on a small scale.
Okay, well.
Not in the galactic scale, but the scale of the supernova, the galactic rotation is so
I thought that the question was basically all these processes happened before.
Well, that's
interesting.
What
that's
field
interesting. Is back down the
perhaps the.
As you know, about that.
I mean, if.
I think she.
If the injection scale is something like this.
I think the picture is.
That's pretty much. That is,
you know, pretty much all of this.
Then characteristic energy in the turbulence on that scale is in coefficient is of order of magnitude. In other words, b squared is 10 kilometers. And then if you do
between
so if that is the energy containing input scale, then on that scale, the helicity, on that scale is a good fraction of the. So you're saying that in other words, if you were trying to inject the relevant helicity in the small scale, would be behind it, as to how it would be there, even though it might be present.
But it is expected that my case would
end. Just like
in my set
getting back to the argument, but again, we hope to do that.
The point is, I'm studying intensive flow rates, that the growth of the mean field on the large scale on campus,
Well,
I bet they do, but I have no idea where it is. Can you fire it up yet?
No, we get the kinematic bridge to be violated on a big road, and we get these twiddles together. So
okay, so you're going to say, okay, say that.
Before any energy is down there, we need to scale.
But I guess to say that it's violent, it doesn't mean that it's that you no longer get the twiddles right. At least I think it just means that if you look at the equation, then those terms are becoming important. That at some time, something like that, it doesn't mean necessarily that the end result is going to be suppressed by that factor. I think it just means that that's the point at which one is considering nonlinear facts. Opposed to saying that, you know,
it's
at the end of the
build-up. But actually, you mean that agreement
that
B is where equal to R?
Yeah. You don't agree with
no.
Me.
No. B twiddles are better.
Right?
Because of that, it levels up for 10 years. Right? If you start with, like,
There'll be three remaining speakers. There they are. One, two, three. I'm the first one.
You could have spelled out your own last name too. You didn't have
time.
The rock star.
So
my physicist formerly known as B.
So let me just. I'm going to say that I think in the previous talks of suppression, there's actually a lot that George and I have worked in collaboration on the things I'm going to talk about that I agree with. And it's more a question of addressing which problem solved in a simulation is related to the actual problem of dynamo theory in a physical system like a sun or a galaxy. And so that's kind of the flavor of what I want to point out here, which is going to show that for an actual physical system, sun or galaxy, the situation has some important differences, which leads to different interpretation of the implications of suppression experiments. So the concept here is magnetic helicity, and let me just first do a small derivation here and then discuss the interpretation. It's known that if you dot the electric field and the magnetic field, and this is in this mean field formalism, you have a term which is composed of the average average part and the fluctuating part, and this you can relate through relating E to its the vector potential and the scalar potential, that this turns out to be a time derivative of the magnetic helicity plus a divergence term, which I don't bother writing, but I keep it there. And it also separately holds for each, you know, when you break this up into the mean and the fluctuating part, you can get similar relationships for E bar dot D bar. That's the time derivative of this helicity associated with the mean quantities, and the small scale also has a similar relationship. So note that there's a time derivative, and this relates to what Pat was talking about, stationarity, that this quantity E dot B has a time derivative and a divergence. Now how do these fit into the picture of what you might constrain for alpha? Well, if you write this out in terms of Ohm's law, this quantity, you can get a relationship which comes in with this turbulent EMF, which is where alpha appears, and this is the relationship for E dot B using Ohm's law, average value. You also get if you don't break the E into its fluctuating and mean components, and just go right to the current, you get this relation. And you can eliminate this from these two relations to get a constraint on the turbulent EMF, and it's in this turbulent EMF where alpha is appearing. Now, if we just assume for the moment that, I mean, so V cross B is this turbulent EMF, which we agree more or less is this is the alpha that's entering. And this term, for the moment, I'm just going to ignore this, the beta term, and just consider it V cross B as being alpha B bar. Then what you can see is that this term, which this lambda is the magnetic diffusivity, you can see that this being an alpha times B bar squared, this should be B bar squared, is limited by a term which depends on the magnetic diffusivity plus this E dot B term here, this term in red. And if you go through a few scaling arguments in terms of what alpha, the maximum that alpha could be, it depends on something like V dot curl of V, which is, and since when the turbulence is an equal partition, V is twiddles the small scale field. So you can sort of relate this to a maximum value of alpha, which could be considered the kinematic value. And when you do that and then scale.
Someone wants to come in.
So when you do this, you find that here, voila, there's an upper limit on alpha, which depends on this term, which has a magnetic Reynoldson number dependence, plus another term, which is this term in red. And if I just copy this formula here, which is the term in red, down here, I have these terms, plus I have this term. So here is a term which looked very much what is found in these Catania-Hugh simulations. And here is extra stuff.
Eric, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Is everything exact with the exception of this inequality? There's no approximation.
I didn't make, from here to here, I didn't do any, I just manipulated the equation.
On the entire page?
That's right. Yeah.
I think it's not quite correct, though, because B dot del cross B in your average there is actually dominated by the diffusion scale.
If that's what you meant. But actually, it depends on how you define alpha max. But if alpha max, if you take this to be alpha, well, it's a little bit tricky because there's a correlation time that enters here. So this quantity, although maybe dominated on a small scale, if you want to relate it to alpha, you also have to divide it by a correlation time, and the correlation time also has a k dependence. So this power to the RM may be something like 3/4 or something like that. Yeah. So that
may be relevant to the previous discussion.
Yeah. So you were getting that's a good point. So in fact, you could put this 3/4. The point here that I would like to make is that this term, which has the magnetic Reynolds number in it, it comes here, but the terms which don't have the magnetic Reynolds number in it are either divergence terms or a time-dependent term. And I would argue that for the case of a periodic box, if you look in a periodic box, you won't have these terms present, stationary and the surface term. And so it's possible that the dynamical suppression that it appears to be seen when the box is in simulations with a periodic box may actually not have terms that can contribute here. And thus, we would agree with the formula that's found for the suppression in such a simulation. The question that arises.
Why does the D by the T relate to the average term? Doesn't make sense.
Stationary? Yeah. The mean. This would have to. Oh no. Well, this is only the alpha effect, right? But there's no growth of any mean quantities in. I'm saying if you have a simulation where the box is periodic and you start off, say, actually, I didn't really want to look too clear. If you take a simulation where you have a uniform field and you have it to be periodic, then there's no growth of the field. The mean field is not going to grow or change.
But you have a D by DT as some average of the.
Right, but this.
Case A and we B.
The only way that can change is if there's a change in it.
We haven't gone. Is there some time scale argument here?
Well, you're assuming
what's
that the turbulence has reached a steady state, so it is not generating more and more small scale velocity.
The small scale is in steady state, just the large scale is growing.
Neither one is growing according to.
This is a mean quantity. There's no change in mean quantities in the case. Well, I'm not.
I'm still not quite sure what you mean by stationary, because the alpha effect is supposed to be amplifying the field.
Stationarity is the turbulence of the fluctuations.
But B squared is proportional to.
The point is well taken. The point that you're making is relevant in the sense that if you want to measure. If you want to measure this for a real system and for an astrophysical system, it's not necessarily true that these quantities are going to vanish. What I'm saying is that if you set up a simulation that has a uniform field in a periodic box and it's stationary, then these terms won't contribute.
Well, I can see the first one, but the second one we have an amplifying field, right?
When you say amplifying field, what scale do you...
Well, that's what we want alpha for, right?
I think he's imposing uniform field on his min field.
Yeah, I'm saying if you apply this relationship to a case in which there is a uniform field across the box, and you ask to measure B cross B, like in the Catania Hughes situation, then my thing is that, and which is stationary, and the turbulence is stationary after some saturation time, then the argument would be that. And the periodic box gets rid of this, and also gets rid of this, because there's no mean quantities can grow in that situation. The mean field cannot grow.
Tanya Hughes, you're talking about 2D, right?
No.
The
one he talked about.
3D, the mean field going through the top to Galloway. Okay.
There's a B squared on the bottom that you missed out with this. The red terms should be divided by a B squared.
Oh, from here, sorry.
B is amplified, right?
No, B is fixed.
Mean B in the derivative of B. So if you take, right, this equation of the mean field, if you take it
as
a uniform...
That's right. Both terms are right.
Then you could write that down.
Well, if there's a... Sorry.
Not imposed, but alpha.
Well, you can have it as
alpha.
Okay,
alpha. Isn't alpha supposed to be
amplifying
the field or the
decision? Alpha is...
The argument is that the time scale for the system... For the mean field to grow is much longer than that. Mm-hmm. The turbulence to adjust the prevailing value of the mean field.
I mean,
the scale is infinite because.
In this case, it's infinite because B naught is uniform. So then J bar is zero, and you didn't have to eliminate it.
No? That is a stupid question. Can you write A dot B as full derivative cosine? Because B is a curve of A, so then it would, due to periodic conditions, integrate.
No, it doesn't work that way. No. They transform into itself.
Why don't you go on, Eric?
Okay, I'll proceed. So the point is, getting a constraint on alpha depends. And what really, on if you do a simulation, one could argue that to get the absolute maximum value of alpha, you have to allow for something to flow through boundaries, or something to, you know, to have a time dependent. So if these things aren't present, then you will appear to get this value. So. So let me just, one of the points also about this, if the averaging scale, if a key point here is that if the averaging scale is over the scale of the box, then, and the box itself is periodic, then that this applies here. But if you imagine, for example, in a star or a galaxy, the scale of averaging, in a sense, is much smaller than the overall global scale. So there's sort of a scale separation in a real astrophysical system between the scale of the object in question and the overall scale in which the object is embedded. So building on that intuition, if you just look at this picture, this is kind of the kind of scale separation for a physical system that would be relevant. There's sort of a mean scale, which is the scale over which you average. That is this averaging scale. But then, and there's no periodicity, of course, across in the boundary, say, of a star or a galaxy. And then there's an outer scale, which is the global universal scale in which this system is embedded. And the fluctuating scale is something smaller. So there's these kind of three scales that, in an astrophysical system, are important to separate. So, building on that point, before where I had this mean.
Can you just satisfy that
engineer, but go back, what is the time scale separation? You have two terms in your alpha, one of which goes like 1 over the magnetic Reynolds number, which makes it incredibly small, and one which you say you ignore because of stationarity. What is the longer time scale than 1 over the magnetic Reynolds number?
Well,
it's an incredibly small thing, the alpha there, unless you have 1 over Rm.
The longest time scale in the problem is the diffuse, is whatever is that resistive time, and so if you want to say that in fact dt by whatever is decaying is ultimately going on the, but the point is that the mean field across the box is not changing.
Yeah, it's the resistive time on the long scale for B bar, which is.
Right. So the time scale, the long, that's the time scale over which that dt by. Isn't
that
fluctuation
elicited decay time, which in fact is the resistive time scale for the line? Right?
If you don't allow for, you can essentially rewrite all fluctuating quantities. This quantity is a mean, more or less, and your mean field in a periodic box cannot change. So whatever time scale you're asking for the mean, since the mean field can't change, the time scale for this to change is infinite, more or less, in a periodic box. I'm only saying that this applies. This vanishes. That these vanish for.
But you're giving us some argument about. Special scales here too.
Okay, but now what?
In which case, there is a time scale for the main field.
Right. That's exactly the point. That's exactly the point. I'm making a transition between a system which has a periodic box for which the mean field can't change in space or time, and now I'm going to say that when you actually consider a real system, these terms are going to be important. That's what I'm saying. So, in other words, it's distinguishing the case between a simulation. Which has conditions set up for which these terms may be small from the outset, versus a real system for which the scales are going to matter. And I'm going to show that when you have the scale separation for real systems, that these terms actually are important. Okay. So. That the absence of those terms, as I said, is not necessarily true for a real system. Here is the separation scale, star, turbulent fluctuation, and other scale. Let's integrate now this global universal scale. Let's integrate this E dot B over all of this volume. And the contribution, so I now have two sort of separate averagings. One is averaging over this scale, and the other is integrating now over the whole volume. Well, when you integrate over the whole volume, although this quantity has divergence terms, those divergence terms are going to go away because those are going away at infinity. I call this global helicity, which is the integrated, so the time derivative of the global helicity is equal to the volume integrated E dot B. And the same applies for each separate component of this one for the fluctuating component average and one for the mean component, that is mean inside this. Now, since the helicity conservation applies, that is, since all of these arguments go through separately for B, for the fluctuating field and the mean field, you can divide the total time derivative of the helicity associated with the small scale and associated with the mean into two terms. Now, you divide, and these terms are divided by a contribution that comes from inside and a contribution that comes from outside. So, a contribution in here and a contribution out here. This turns out to make these gauge invariants, Berger and Field, define something called the relative helicity, which is essentially the difference between the helicity, relative helicity of the inside is the is the helicity associated with the actual field inside minus the helicity associated with the potential field inside. But for purposes of this argument, it's okay to leave it sort of schematically as such.
When you say inside, you mean in a place?
In a place.
In a place in wavelength space.
I mean in a spatial place, spatial location.
In a real place.
Yeah, exactly. So in the location inside of the red. Now, if we imagine that this red applies to something like a star, sun, let's assume that, so for example, the sun over a time scale with respect to the field reverse, the solar cycle time scale, short compared to the solar cycle time scale, but long compared to, say, a rotational convection time scale, let's assume that the system is in a steady state. I mean, just to explore one consequence of considering the scale separation and the helicity conservation. In that case, so that means that we pick the relative helicity associated with the inside and of the small scale field and the mean field to be zero, time derivative, to be zero. And when you then write out what that is in terms of the relative helicity and the E bar dot D bar, you get this relationship. So what does this mean? And you also get a similar relationship for that associated with the small scale. So small and large scale have also a similar relationship. So what you can see, and this S is the surface bounding interfacing between the outer and the inner region. So what you can see is that the time derivative of essentially the helicity here, this being zero, means that you're producing some source of magnetic helicity, and it's flowing, and it's balanced by a flow of this quantity out through the boundary. So if you want to maintain a steady state inside the object, something has to flow through the boundary. And because E bar, and what is this quantity? E bar dot B bar, of course, relates to alpha, so it's alpha B squared. So it's the integral of alpha B bar squared. And also you'll note that since the total E dot B for highly conducting plasmas, total is approximately conserved, these are going to have the opposite sign. That is, E dot B is equal to more or less zero, and that's the sum of these two terms, E bar dot B bar. So since E dot B average value is equal to zero.
What average are we talking about now?
That's average. That average is inside the
in.
Inside, right?
What is that?
Well, it actually doesn't matter where you pick that. It's just high Reynolds number. In other words, all I was going to write down was that.
Yeah, it was a little approximation, yeah.
Well, that